Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Chinese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Subi Rautio, and I am one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Roberta Zavoretti, affiliated member of the Global South Studies Center at the University of Cologne. Roberta is here to talk about her new book, Rural Origins, City Lives, Class and Place in Contemporary China, which was published in 2017 by University of Washington Press, and in the autumn of 2020 came out in paperback. Based on her long-term ethnographic fieldwork among a diverse group of migrant workers in the city of Nanjing, Roberta Zavoretti's book offers a nuanced and critical ethnographic account of internal labor migration in China. Rural Origins, City Lives probes long-held assumptions about migrant workers who live and work in increasingly stratified and diversified Chinese cities. Roberta Zavoretti does an excellent job at portraying this diversity through the aspirations and everyday lives of rural-born urban dwellers to argue against policy discourse and media portrayals that project migrants as a homogenous group. In doing so, Rural Origins, City Lives argues that after more than 30 years of open-door reform, class formation, not resident status, is key to understanding inequality in contemporary China today. We will be discussing these chapters in more details with Roberta, who we have the pleasure of joining us on the show today. Roberta, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for your invitation.
So I'd like to begin today's discussion by asking you about your background and how you grew to be interested in doing anthropological research on rural-born urban dwellers in China.
Yes, it's actually a fairly long story. I've studied Chinese studies in Italy as a very young woman for 5 years. Got my degree there. It was before the Bologna process. That means that it was a rather long degree comparable to a master's degree nowadays. And then I did other kind of jobs, mainly in Brussels, related to the European Union. And then at a certain point, I decided that I wanted to go back to studying, and I moved to London where I did that. I started anthropology at the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, gaining a master's and then later on a PhD. The choice of anthropology was something that came about actually after working in policy for a few years, because I really felt the need for a micro, highly qualitative research approach that could give a better understanding of why things happen in ways that policy is often unable to either grasp or predict. And I thought that anthropology with ethnography and a rather eclectic spectrum of theory as well was offering that possibility. I totally fell in love with the discipline at first, and it seemed a natural choice for me to go back to China to do my fieldwork because, of course, I had already some kind of experience of living there. I could speak the language. And I had still several contacts there. The issue of migration was an issue that had always interested me, partly because I've been a migrant myself most of my life. I also come from a country where many people are migrants. So Italy is a classic example of a country with lots of out migration and internal migration as well. It was also something that seemed to me very urgent, very urgent on headlines and on research papers for a long time. Since the 90s, there was a lot of literary production on this topic. And therefore, when I suggested this project to my supervisor, everybody was kind of happy with it. It was not very clear to me what I was going to do because I had read a lot of literature and it seemed to me like everything had already been written. But to some extent, I was not fully satisfied with what had been published. Although lots of books, monographs, you know, and articles on internal migration in China are extremely insightful and fascinating. But to some extent, I felt that there was a little contribution that perhaps somebody else could give. And this is the feeling that actually brought me to the field.
Yeah, and I think that you in the introduction itself, so the introduction is titled The Paradigm of Ruled Urban Migration in Contemporary China. And in the introduction, you really outline this wealth of other migrant research being conducted both in China and, of course, across the world. And you present this background in a very insightful and descriptive manner. And then at the same time, you describe your first impressions of peasant workers in China, so the Nongmingong. And in this chapter, by doing so, you trace these discussions and the trends of that you focus on migrant labor in China. And just like you were saying now, you point out the gap, which is that so much of this research tends to focus on official discourse on quality, in other words, 素质 and modernity. Whereas at the same time, scholars, by focusing on this discourse, you argue that scholars too easily fall into the mistake of generalizing rural migrants into a homogenous category. Or this is at least how I interpreted your description of the wealth of scholarly work that's being completed on migrant studies at the time. So thereby, by generalizing the rural migrant, these categories of rural and urban easily become fixed realities and thereby kind of opposed to one another. Perhaps you could tell our listeners a bit more about the Chinese urban context in migrant studies and a bit more about these representations and the images that are often projected onto workers who undergo labor migration in China.
Yes. I think the introduction attempts exactly to do that, to actually give a picture of what this paradigm is. It's very difficult for us to understand it, for us, I mean, from the perspective of somebody living on the European continent, I think, because we do not have this perception of the migrant as a bureaucratic category, which is instead fact in China, right? Or it has been for so long, at least, because of the fact of the household registration that has been for a very long time a fixed part of somebody's life, something that was not possible to change easily, and that was a state bureaucratic category, which means that you can very well live in a city for 20 years, or you can even be born in a city and still have a rural household registration in China is very normal, or was very normal. And this has historical reasons, which are very well documented, and so on and so forth. So this is an actual, I don't like to use the word truth, right? But this is an actual truth in China. So it's not a shortcoming of literature to point that out. It's actually a fact. On the other hand, yeah, we're not only speaking of a bureaucratic category, we're speaking of a whole commonsensical way of thinking about the world, which means that that in common speech, in everyday practice, speaking about migrant, so internal migrant in China, means a very specific thing that is portrayed on the media, is portrayed on propaganda, is continuously referred to in many ways. it's just basically a talk about a character that is a very specific character with very, very specific features, and that basically immediately recalls a whole political discourse that is actually quite complex. When I started doing fieldwork, I was really amazed about how stable this category seemed to be in common speech, in dialogues, in discussions, and so on and so forth. But then when I had to do the fieldwork in the everyday, so the nitty-gritty of fieldwork, you know, making, establishing relationships with people, and trying to follow them everywhere they go, trying to get into their lives and participate in what they do and so on and so forth. It was actually an extremely unstable category. Very, very difficult to put your finger on what a rural migrant is. Rural urban migrant, I mean. So this was one of the paradoxes I had to deal with during the first few months of the fieldwork, right? So on the one hand, a very stabilized kind of narrative about what a rural to urban migrant is or is supposed to be, and how they look, how they behave, where they're coming from, what they're going to do with their lives. All of this is extremely fixed in the narrative. And then on the other hand, in the practice, in the everyday practice of fieldwork, it was often quite difficult to figure out who was doing what and who were coming from where. It was a lot messier, as often we find, right? So this is basically one of the first sparks behind the whole book.
And then in the first chapter, so the first chapter is titled "Who is a Peasant Worker?" You really go into more detail on what these to rural born urban dwellers. Perhaps you could tell our listeners, who maybe not all of them might be so familiar with the Chinese context, perhaps you could tell our listeners a bit more about these labels that you encountered during your fieldwork that were being attached to your interlocutors.
Yes. Well, the rural to urban migrant worker is somebody who is generally has a history of migration in his or her family, at least. And the fact that the rural to urban migrant worker, or how I call them in the book, the rural-born dwellers of the city, they don't have a history, family history in the city, so often they used to lack household registration, has a whole number of very concrete and material consequences in their lives. But in this first chapter, what was interesting to me was that despite this very material and concrete aspect linked to household registration, linked to professional activity, linked to educational level and so on and so forth, there was a whole number of strategies that people had in order to position themselves in one way or another vis-a-vis this whole paradigm of the migrant worker. So there were people who had to embrace it because it was obvious that they were at the bottom layer of society, and therefore they would be very direct on the fact that they were outsiders, because at the end of the day, this is what we are talking about, right? They were outsiders economically, politically, socially, and so on and so forth. And then there were people who had a little bit of a cleaner job, who were maybe a little bit younger, spoke perhaps a better Mandarin without such a strong accent, and so on and so forth. And these could actually try to pass independently from what their bureaucratic administrative status was, right? This could actually try to pass, and they really tried. And I think my ethnography is not the only one that mentioned this. But they really tried to pass as as people belonging to a different kind of background and as people belonging to a different kind of class, right? So in here, you already see what are the issues that come to intersect with each other. So to say, it's class, right? It's geographical origin that is easily recognizable in China, for example, through the language, through how people speak. It's gender, so how you perform femininity or masculinity in a particular way rather than in another. And we could go on, another one very important, health, for example, the fact that the rural to urban migrant worker is always perceived as a threat to public health, right? Or a threat to public order. So what was interesting for me at the beginning was to see how people who are in that situation of being outsiders, of belonging to, of basically dwelling in a place where they will always feel outsiders probably, or they will always be defined as outsiders, no matter how long they stay there. So how do these people deal with this? You know, what strategies do they have in the everyday to actually try and cope with this unbelievably heavy situation? And I found a lot of creativity in this, and a lot of humor as well, unsurprisingly. This is basically what the first chapter is about.
Yeah, and then in chapter two, you really move closer to looking at how these identities, for example, class, language, fashion, gender, are being negotiated through relatedness. So chapter two is titled Speaking of Oneself. And in this chapter, you describe the webs of relationships that constituted your interlocutor's social, moral, and emotional subjectivities, and thereby allowed them to position themselves in relation to Nanjing urbanites. Could you tell us a bit more about this? How did your interlocutors negotiate these identities, and how did their experiences of migration play into these narratives?
Yeah. The second chapter actually came about, let's say, fairly naturally, as I started to get more intimate with the people I was working with. So it was very interesting to me to see how people define themselves in ways that were not so affine to the ways in which the official narrative defines migrant workers. Well, you know better than me, of course, but just for those who are not particularly familiar with China, the official narrative on the migrant worker in China can be at times extremely individualistic, right? Can be extremely focused on the migrant worker, projected on modernity, that faces a dangerous trip into the site of modernity, so the big megalopolis, in order to basically win his or her own underdevelopment. I'm putting it in extremely raw and crude terms, but sometimes when you read, you know, newspaper articles or you see television representations of migration, at times the discourse is very similar to that. And this is always a very interesting thing about China, that you have a state that has such a very strong and powerful. On the other hand, when you actually talk to people, this is always in the background, but people tend to define themselves in completely different ways. They tend to define themselves relationally. They don't tend to define themselves as, you know, fearless individuals on the path to modernity. They can do that sometimes, but overall, in the everyday, especially if you don't do a lot of interviews, you do a lot of participant observations, so you see them in the very menial everyday tasks, right? they tend to define themselves relationally. So relationally means in just the position with somebody else or in relation to somebody else. So in just the position to the people who have, for example, an office job and they don't need to work manually, right? So they've never been farming, they've never been working on the street for 12 hours in a row, etc. Or in relation to somebody else that is similar to me. So my village mate, for example, my relative, the person who speaks the same language I speak, and so on and so forth. Or the person who does the same job I do. And this I found also very illuminating, because it really allows you to step a little bit aside of this official narrative of the rural to urban migrant worker or the rural born city dweller as either a winning agent or failing agent of modernity. You know, I really wanted to kind of step aside from this official narrative, because it is so powerful and overwhelming that sometimes it obscures more than it illuminates. Although it's very important to keep in mind that it's there and that you have to deal with it. But sometimes it's not very helpful in actually figuring out what people do with their lives, or what people do with that particular narrative themselves.
Yeah, exactly. It's one thing how people are described through, as you describe in your book, through media representations, through TV shows, through soap operas, and then of course the political discourse. And also what I also really enjoyed about your book is that you attended a lot of lectures during your time in Nanjing, and you also describe these dialogues, these communications you had with scholars who were writing and talking about or using the language of this kind of political discourse through their own work. And I think it was really insightful that you provide these conversations you had with these scholars in your work to kind of position both position yourself as an academic, but also position the wider discourse. Before we move on, because you've been talking you've mentioned quite a few times the kind of the jobs that help people relate to others through jobs and through different identities. But perhaps you could tell our listeners what kind of jobs did your interlocutors do? So you have quite a few field sites in Nanjing. Perhaps you could provide a very brief overview of these field sites and the people that you were working with there, just so the listeners have an idea on the or an impression on the field site.
Yeah, sure. It was actually a fairly unusual approach because what you mentioned, Nanjing is a particular, it's not a very particular kind of city, but it's not the city where people would tend to do a classic study of rural to urban migration in China. So the most classic studies we have, well, I am thinking about the one study that for me is the great classic in the field, Strangers in the City by Li Zhang. Well, this was a very early, super timely book, very well written, that I would suggest everybody reads. Because I still find it so insightful. And it was based in Beijing, right? So the capital that offered a very, very clearly sealed enclave, ethnically and linguistically homogeneous. So this is one type, right? Probably more difficult to do that nowadays because, of course, the size of migration has changed since then. We are talking about a book published in, I think, 2001. So a few years have passed. Then there is another kind of a book that you find easily in the genre, which is the ethnography, the factory ethnography, shop floor ethnography, right? So that would be mainly books like Made in China, for example, that bring you to basically the south of the country in special economic zones with lots of factories and people living in dormitories and so on and so forth. I didn't want to do this kind of ethnography. I thought that the literature on this kind of environment was already very rich and very telling. Lots of very interesting debates, but I didn't feel I could contribute a lot doing another shop floor ethnography. Nanjing is a large city. It's not one of the largest cities in China, but it's a large city. And it's a city that is considered to be also a cultural center in many ways. So it's not, it is an industrial city as well, but it's not only that. And I have to say, I was extremely lucky with the Department of Sociology of Nanjing University that hosted me in the best possible way from my point of view. This included that. This included inviting me to participate to the life of the department, where I learned an enormous amount about China in general and about Chinese academia in particular. But Nanjing in itself was not the kind of place where people would expect me to do that kind of research. So even when I was at the department, some people would tell me, why do you do this kind of research here? You know, there is nothing for you to find here. You should go to Guangdong and you should do shop floor ethnography. And, you know, Nanjing was at the time already a very large metropolis, and it would be with a been impossible for the whole economy to run without in-migration of labor. So in fact, most of the people who were working in retail, for example, in this kind of small size industry were actually people who had some kind of history of migration. It was very easy to figure that out. Just because the size of the of population movement in China now is so enormous, and the field sites I had to isolate some kind of small field sites within big megalopolis, of course, and I decided to actually look at three different groups of workers, so workers who work on the street as sellers, so street peddlers. Then workers working in a tailor shop. Of course, textile industry is enormous in China, and it's a very big sector. These ones were working in a shop selling clothes, tailored clothes. And then the third group was a group of bakers and cake sellers that were working for a small size enterprise owned by a European entrepreneur, but everything very small. So all the three field sites were comparable in a way that they were geographically close to each other. They were small size enterprises of different types, of course, but still very small. And they actually employed very similar kind of people, sociologically speaking, very similar educational level, very similar geographical and class background. But then already there, despite the homogeneity of the people working in these different businesses, you could see some very obvious differences related to the practice of the work, related to visions of the future and of the present, related to political visions as well. Very different political horizons, which was extremely interesting to actually analyze.
Hmm. Yeah, and I'm wondering if another similarity was how your interlocutors kind of defined what in chapter 3 of your book you describe as a kind of stuck in between two places. So I'm quoting directly from your book. You said, you write, dwelling in remote fringes or constrained spaces that do not belong to either the countryside or the properly urban center, such as factories and dormitories. So can you tell our listeners a bit more about about this notion of stuck in between, and also this kind of, is this also a call to redefine how urban spaces are being described in contemporary Chinese, or not just described, but how they're being lived in, and being reshaped?
Yeah. This idea of being stuck in between is very rooted in the genre of in this genre of ethnography, and it's both spatial and temporal. So it's both being stuck in between spatially and time wise, right? The space is very intuitive. It's just because we always read of rural to urban migrant workers as living in dormitories, as living in areas where nobody else wants to live, and therefore it's fairly easy to define these spaces as peripheries or interstitial spaces, and so on and so forth. And the time aspect is also there because, of course, there is this idea that since these people do not belong to the city, they don't really have a future there, right? There is a lot of talk about that. There is less talk about the idea of going back, for example, which I think is also a consequence of the modernity narrative, right? The modernity narrative of the state is always projected on the future. Therefore, we tend to look at the future. But in fact, there are lots of people who go to the city to work and then decide to go back to the village, right? And we have lots less data, for example, about what happens to these people who try to go back. There has been some interesting work done on education in that respect. But apart from that, it would be very interesting to see actually how many people lose their land rights. You know, land grabbing is an enormous issue in rural China. You probably know better than me. And but just to give an example of how the modernity narrative of the state affects already in a very macroscopic way our point of view, right? Including mine. I mean, I'm definitely putting myself into this lot. But yeah, to go back to this idea of being stuck in between is a very, very established idea in the genre. But then the point is, if you've ever been in a Chinese megalopolis, you know that there is an enormous amount of life on the public space, right? It's definitely different from a city in, say, the UK. it's very, very different in that respect. People basically stick around on the street almost every day, all day long, especially people who are employed in certain kind of jobs, working class jobs, so manual jobs, retail jobs, and so on and so forth. Many of these people at least, of course not all, but many of these people actually have a migration history or have had in their family a migration history. Which means that you can be in the city center, in the very city center of the city, and have to deal with a lot of people who have had this migration history in their lives, in their families, and so on and so forth. And it's very hard actually to figure out why you should call these spaces interstitial spaces if they are so right in the city center. So sometimes it is a little bit of a chicken and egg argument. You find out that we call interstitial spaces those spaces where we find poor people hanging out, and vice versa. We decide that poor people are those who are sticking in specific places, and so it basically feeds itself. Of course, for many people, there was an issue of trying to live close to their working place, which meant that many people I worked with had to live in very cramped accommodation. So, for example, one of the families with whom I was whom I was closer was living in the basement. But I mean, they were people working in the extreme center of a cultural capital, so in the real center of a cultural capital in China. And yes, and by all means, you probably have also met people with urban household registration who have to live in basements in big megalopolis in China just because the cost of living, the cost of accommodation is so ridiculous, right? So basically, third chapter it tries to put in question all these assumptions, and also this assumption regarding the trajectory of not only the spatial trajectory but also the time trajectory. The fact that for those who have an urban household registration, it's very difficult to accept that those who have a rural household registration might not want to go back to the country, might not want to accept that as a fixed destiny that you cannot change and that, you know, will hang on you as a Damocles sword for the rest of your life, right? That they are actually occupying this space with a vision of staying there and having a life there and having children there that will grow up as urban citizens and so on and so forth. I thought this kind of relation between time and space was very important to highlight because it's mutually constructed, right? It's really mutually constructed. And also this fact that to some extent the rural dweller is always implicitly associated with the Maoist past and with this idea that the Maoist past was to some extent something that you want to leave behind, you know, to project yourself on this future of city lights. This is also connected to these visions.
Yeah, and that really, I think it's a good way of where you bridge on to the fourth chapter of your book titled Earning, Spending, and Consuming. And you write about more general discussions on notions of personal success in urban China and judgments that are posed on rural migrant workers as failed consumers. And this also, just now, as you were saying, the kind of the lack of scholarly work on returning migrants. So a lot of my research in Guizhou and in a village in Guizhou was on returning migrants and consumption, and this, you know, this notion of them as failed consumers was as far from reality as possible. Most of the young returnees dressed lavishly, you know, had as much bling as possible. Their hair was like they'd come straight from the barber almost every time they stepped outside. So your chapter has a point. This notion of the failed consumer is something that's attached to the rural migrant worker, and perhaps that's something that you could tell our listeners a bit more about. What kind of earning, spending, and consumption practices did you observe amongst your interlocutors, and how did you interpret these practices to argue against the idea of them being failed consumers?
Yeah. The issue of consumption is extremely interesting in a socialist society, right? Because so many of the things that nowadays people have to buy on the free market, just up to a few generations ago, even less than two generations ago, were supposed to be provided by the state, right? For almost for free, at least in the cities. And actually, this vision of the city as a good place to live, you know, as a place for the good life, comes from that. For most of my informants, comes from the fact that, a person of my age, roughly born in early to mid 70s. Grew up in a world where the best schools were in the city, the hospitals were in the city, the roads in the city were good, so were walkable. You didn't have to build your own road, and there was electricity in the house. You didn't have to live without electricity or without running water. These are ideas very much linked to the socialist past, which is not so far away, despite, you know, what we like to think, but still very present in people's memory. And this is a very interesting spin-off on the consumption strategies of people, and especially on the vision of consumption, right? When I used to speak at the beginning of fieldwork with people about why they came to the city, which is this typical question that you pose as a very fresh ethnographer, not very experienced, right? People would really give me this kind of dominant narrative that we want to consume like city people do, right? And then you see how they consume, and it's actually they try to buy all these things that the city people in the socialist past had as an entitlement. So they buy education for the kids, they buy hospital care for family members when they get sick. They try to buy a house, of course, right? Also because a house big enough used to give a chance to get a household registration, which in turn used to give also other kinds of possibilities. But yeah, this contrasts very much with all the press you get on Chinese rural to urban migrant workers, especially in the media and state propaganda, where they, you know, as we said, they are often portrayed as a threat to public order and to public health. They are often portrayed as people of lower quality. And part of this is that they are also portrayed as very bad consumers. So people who do not really know what to do with the money and therefore shouldn't earn any, basically, right? Because if they have it, they spend it, they squander it. And if they don't have it, they kill themselves to spare up to the last penny. So it all goes back to this narrative of the rural to urban migrant worker, somebody cannot really take care of himself or herself and needs the state to take responsibility for him or her, right? What I found was obviously a very, very different kind of picture that, to my own surprise at that time, I have to say, was...
Yeah, and this also really... This bridges nicely with the next chapter, Negotiating Success, where you look at the notion of success as the enterprise of migration and money-making. And you describe a really, really fantastic description through ethnography on how social relationships and continuity bind people together to define success. Perhaps you could tell us a bit more about these diverging visions of success that were so important to your interlocutors?
Yeah, sure. The issue of consumption is really related to this idea of success, because as you said, there is this image of the successful consumer, so the successful person both in earning and in spending. So has money, has taste, is competitive on the job market, and so on and so forth. Of course, it's very easy to pitch this ideal, you know, upper middle class ideal subject, if you want to use the term, against this paradigm of the rural to urban migrant worker who is dirty, low, badly educated, unable to take care of him or herself, and so on and so forth. And as you know, the idea of success nowadays in China is one of the pillars of the state ideology, right? Everybody's really pushed to be successful in their own way, to find their own way to be better, to get better, to be richer, and so on and so forth. In this respect, I think I was really inspired by the lives of the informants towards the end of my fieldwork, because it was the moment often happens. It happens. It was the moment in which I actually managed to get a little bit more inside family issues and family lives, and I managed to figure out the amount of importance that family life has or had at that time for my informants. It is really the core, not only in terms of visions of that they have about their own lives, but it is even the material core. Because of course, when you make your living by running a family enterprise or by working in a family enterprise, family is also the one institution that guarantees your subsistence, right? And with your subsistence, it guarantees your affective subsistence, it guarantees your vision of the future, it guarantees all of these things. That's really at the ground of what it means to be human for you. So I also realized that for most of my informants, it would have been pointless to talk about having a good life, having a successful life, if you want, without putting family at the center. And this was not only an empty kind of rhetoric. This was something that they were doing in the everyday, right? With everyday little and big actions. And so it was also inspiring to pitch this against this whole rhetoric of romance that is now very fashionable in China, which is a very important part of the narrative of modernity, right? The fact that China is a modern state that allows people to choose freely their partner and to experiment during the youth, to basically buy a diamond ring to the one that is loved, or a bunch of flowers and so on and so forth. All things that, of course, during high socialism, Maoism were totally politically incorrect, let alone possible. I mean, very difficult to buy a diamond ring in the high moments of Maoism, of course. So there was an interesting contrast there between this official narrative of romantic modernity, which is of course also linked to consumption and to the landscape of the city, and then this extremely sober choices in terms of personal relationships, even austere in some way, right? Extremely pragmatic and yet not void of affection. And I think this is something very important to point out, because also this just the position between necessity and feelings is something that is very crucial to the family policy of the party in the 20th century and 21st century still, right? So the feudal times were the times of necessity, in which you would marry because your parents forced you into marriage. But the new China is a China that allows you to choose your spouse and to decide how you want to lead your family life according to your love, to your affection. What I found is way more complex, unsurprisingly, the fact that the people have to make pragmatic choices in terms of family relations, because family relations are so fundamental to survival, to physical survival, on the top of, any other kind of survival. And on the other hand, the fact that truly strong affective bonds managed to emerge in this context, which flies completely in the face of this opposition between money, the world of money, and the world of emotion. Right? It's much more of a structure that we have in our head sometimes. And then, my own experience doing ethnography was actually a very intricate landscape in that sense, where these things actually are much more enmeshed than we generally expect.
Yeah, and then moving on to your conclusion, which you title Making Place and Making Class, you return to the key theme that your ethnography pushes towards, which is to look at migration and mobility less as fixed categories, but instead as fluid entities that people elaborate and reinvent in their own terms and practices. You also point towards larger discussions on China's urban and rural divide, for example, what some scholars have defined as the two-tried welfare state, which you've already described, where urban residents have access to welfare and rural residents have access to land. But rather than leaving it there, you really, revealed the gaps, the cracks in the system to construe this divide and remind the reader that even China's urban residents struggle to access basic welfare, such as education for their children and healthcare, let alone these urban rural dwellers who move to China's cities. Can you tell us a bit more about these struggles and how it further marginalizes your interlocutors or informants?
I thank you for this question, because we haven't really talked so much about the urban residents so far, which is important part, I think, of the book and of the ethnography. We've talked about how my informants, like rural-born informants, rural-born city dwellers, have a very strong memory of what used to be the welfare provision during the socialist Maoist time in the city. We need to keep in mind that Chinese cities look extremely different nowadays, not only in terms of skyline, but also in terms of welfare provision. So much of the previously public welfare provision has been privatized or is on the way to being privatized, which means that also for people who have a household registration, this one will not be enough as a guarantee of welfare provision. By welfare, I mean really welfare provision as widely conceived category, right? Healthcare, pensions, even education. Lots of extremely interesting things are happening in the field of education that has been privatized for several decades now. At all levels. it would be very naive to think that just because somebody has a urban registration in a big megalopolis in China nowadays, this person has free access to good healthcare, good education for his or her kids, or what used to be the case back in the time, housing. For example, housing is really the one sector where it's where the shift is most macroscopic, because we have this estate bubble in most Chinese cities that makes it extremely difficult to buy housing and to rent it as well. It's very expensive to rent housing. And at the same time, housing has also this very strong meaning as that one concrete foothold in a particular place, right? So during Maoist times, probably with a urban household registration and a job in the city, you would probably be given housing by your danwei, by your working unit. Nowadays, it's generally not the case anymore. It can happen for some privileged state jobs, of course, and Luigi Tomba has written a lot about this. But for many, many other jobs, for all those people who work in private companies, this is not the case. You have to buy housing on the market, or you have to rent it. So it's just not enough to have a household registration in the city to get access to a work unit that will give you housing. On the other hand, if you buy housing and you don't have an urban household registration, then you can get one, probably, which is a funny inversion, as I say. And many people actually manage to do that at a very high price, of course, of great sacrifices. But many people manage to do that. And this poses a problem for the state discourse, because if many migrant workers actually manage to buy housing and to get registration, then it is so macroscopic to those who have household registration in the city but cannot manage to buy housing that there is not such a big of a difference. And if there is no such a big of a difference, we don't need to feel we are against each other or we need to compete, right? We can build alliances, which is exactly what the state power doesn't want to happen. Of course, state power doesn't want people to figure out that there is a working class that is excluded from privileges in China, because that would be in total opposition to state discourse and propaganda. It's much more useful for the state to convince people that there is such a thing as the migrant worker that will always be different from you, and therefore you may need to be scared from scared about him or her, or that you are such a person and therefore you have to work harder to improve yourself, right? But I think this also links up to another book that has been written later on in the following years, The Spectre of the People, which is basically a very affine argument. So that there is this fundamental problem in a country like China that has very, very clear class inequality, but at the same time has the ideological need to proclaim itself socialist, right? That what do you do with all these groups of people who are obviously excluded from redistribution of wealth and might get pretty worked up about it? One of the things you can do with them is to try to convince them that they are not one group, that they are different groups, that they are different, right? That some of you is a migrant worker, so that, you know, you cannot really be friends with them. You cannot have the same class interests with them. And I think this so far has worked particularly successfully in China, has been a very successful rhetoric twist of the government, including in academic production. So the fact that it's been also successful in academic production from my point of view, is a clear sign of that. But on the other hand, yes, social mobility as such is also a very, very important ideological pillar for the socialist state, in the Chinese state. There is a need to maintain it as a working instrument of control as well. In that sense, I was saying, let's try to look at it much less as a thing, but as a unstable signifier that can be renegotiated.
Really fascinating, Roberta. Thank you for providing me and the listeners of this show such detailed descriptions and of the book itself, and expanding also beyond the chapters. I've taken up a lot of your time today, but I wanted to conclude the conversation to talk a bit about what you're working on and thinking about these days. So what kind of projects have you picked up since Rural Origins, City Lives was published?
Yes, well, I actually followed quite linear way from where I had left things at the end of the book, and I grew more interested in kinship and family relations, and discovered that it's an extremely intricate field. This is why many anthropologists tell you that you can study many fields, but once you arrive to kinship, it will be your last field. Somehow I grew to understand that quite deeply, because I, of course, it's not so much like seeing the end of the light at the end of the tunnel, but just seeing one small light at the end of one small tunnel and getting ready for the next one. And I did a bit of research in the past years on marriage and social mobility, which is very related to what you actually can read in the book. But looks also at other social groups of different kind. Quite a bit of this work has already been published in journal articles and book chapters. And I would like to go on in this sense, but looking at relations that are not generally legitimated by official kinship, which I think in post-Mao China is an interesting topic, because we have a situation in which the law is particularly clear about certain things. Also, as we were saying before, a law very much grounded on a strong modernity narrative. And on the other hand, you have a much more variegated social reality in terms of building care relations, right? And in care studies, of course, there has been a very fruitful debate on how care can contribute to kinship theory by highlighting that kin might be something very different from the blood kinship we tend to be used to in more old style anthropology. So yeah, this is basically the themes I'm more oriented to at the moment. Although of course with the current situation it is very, very difficult to see what will happen. I hope to be able to go back to China as soon as possible, but it's at the moment not particularly easy to do that.
Yes, I feel you on that, and we just have to hope that situation changes relatively soon. So you've been building on the same material basically, on the love and kinship as your field work in Nanjing. Is that correct?
No, not really. I mean, some of my informants have remained, and I hope will remain for a longer time. No, but I was lucky enough to do some more fieldwork during the years I spent at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology, which allowed me to actually gather quite a lot of material on specific issues related to mutual construction of gender and class, intergenerational relations, care relations more widely. Some of the informants you will read about in the book are also informants for my second stretch of research, but not all, because I went for a broader kind of spectrum of informants. So trying to compare what happens in different milieus, in different social classes, highly educated people with good, you know, middle-class jobs, for example, vis-a-vis the people who are manual workers and they have to basically take the decisions on fairly different kind of grounds. So, yeah, it's actually, the material is often quite different from what comes out of the book, but there is also a lot of continuity.
Okay, that sounds really intriguing, and I have to familiarize myself more with your more recent work. And I also recommend all the listeners to go out and buy the paperback version of Rural Origins and City Lives. And meanwhile, Roberta Zavoretti, we really look forward to seeing how the rest of your research or new research, new projects unfold. But for now, I wanted to thank you for being on the show today. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to New Books in China Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Thank you, Roberta Zavoretti.
Thank you, Sui. Thank you. And thanks to all the listeners as well. Bye.